Now, as we're going to talk about a couple of years later, this idea of matterness is the latest iteration. And what happened, Leora, was the network nonprofit is out there. A whole bunch of people, not just me and Beth, are telling organizations this is how you use the tool set and this is what happens and you have to be in conversation. And yet we're not seeing the movement towards acting like social networks that we were hoping for. And a couple of years ago, I was at the UJA down the street here, and there was a meeting with the Synergy Group, which was great fun. And Adina Friedman posed a question to the group. She said, when you walk into a synagogue, what is it that you most want to feel? And I paused because I was just brand new as temple president at that time. And I thought to myself, what I want to feel most of all is that I matter as a person. I want to feel like I walk into this building or online, it could be online or on land, and people know who I am. I am not a number. I'm not a check writer. I am a person. They know my story. They're interested in my opinions. And that's where this new idea came from, that there had to be a different way of leading organizations. Because we have this tool set that allows this amazing reach so that more and more people could feel like they really matter to us.
All right. So I'm going to take a big step back and then a
A
big
big
step
leap
forward.
forward.
Exactly.
I got it.
So the big step
Good.
back is if you can just give a little bit about your background. How did you, who are
Sure.
you? How did you even come to start writing about these things? Why should I listen to you more
Why should,
than,
well, you don't have
my neighbor? Yes.
to. You could. Well, here, I'll go way, way back for
That's fine.
you, right? Show my age. As I was telling you just before we started, Leora, I went to Vanderbilt University as an undergrad. And then I came home. I grew up in Sleepy Hollow in Westchester. That's Sleepy Hollow. It's our time of year now. Across the street from the cemetery, which I've never been in
Because
yet.
it's haunted.
Because it's scary.
Right.
Why would anybody want to go into that cemetery?
Exactly.
And at 22 years old, I was elected to the town council. And I was appointed the fire and police commissioner. And it was the most eye-opening experience of my life, of what people expect from leaders, of what I was unprepared to do, how could I be prepared for that. But most of all, and it's particularly resonant now, just how much people wanted to be heard. That's what came through. It's a very small village. I knew most of the people there. They wanted their voices heard, and we see the same thing now in the presidential election. We see this over and over again, this great frustration that I think is growing, actually, of people feeling anonymous, of people feeling disempowered by institutions. So after that, I moved to DC and started an organization called Innovation Network that it still exists and provides evaluation services. But not to evaluate nonprofit programs, to teach leaders how to self-assess, how
Right.
to be their own measurers. So everything I've always done, Leora, is how to empower people to become more knowledgeable, to be in conversation with their own people, and most of all, particularly now with social media, to stop working at people out there and to start working with them. And that is the biggest shift that we hope, I hope people can take away from this idea of matterness.
Right. This idea of not working at people, but working with people.
You know,
And
yeah.
that's a question that I actually had from reading not the first book, which now I clearly need to go
I'll
back and
give
read
it
the
to
first
you.
book, but from reading the second two books was how did that transition shift from network nonprofit, which really was about social media and how
Yes.
does an organization use social media to its best effect, is shifting really in some ways what feels like is probably at its core a both and.
Yeah.
But on the surface feels a little bit like now we're shifting to matterness, to people, to communication, and to
Yeah.
connecting with one another. And so one of my questions was, what changed in the last 3 to 5 years that really pushed you to say, all right, we've now got a handle on how to do the social networking piece and how to connect people through social networking, but now we really need to remind people that what we're trying to connect are people to
Right,
one another.
right.
So how did that sort of come about?
It came about actually because of my frustration that what was happening in a lot of what I would call traditional organizations, organizations that were started last century,
mm-hmm.
come from that hierarchical top-down model,
yep.
that it was very easy for the leadership of those organizations to dismiss and diminish what was happening online as something technical.
Yeah.
And when they were marginalizing it, and sending the interns down the hallway to do it, right? And when you hear over and over again, I don't know which button to push, and I'm not interested, and it doesn't matter. That's a leadership problem, because these same organizations, born and bred last century, now have a millennial problem. They are not connecting with younger people because they don't live online where those folks are. This is a fundamental leadership problem. To make it specific to synagogues,
yes.
what we have is, I think, a values problem. Right. We really do, right? That the synagogue still organized as those fortresses, right? High walls, wide moats, hard to get in, hard to see in, much less hard to get out. What they think they're doing, because they're working very hard internally to do really good things, is not how people are perceiving them. And we see this in survey after survey, and it is the disconnect between what's happening behind those high walls, the experience of people out there, and the place to close the gap. The easiest place to do it starts online.
Right.
And that's a leadership issue. You can't just have the intern doing this.
Right. And I think that that also goes back to some extent to what you had said earlier about it being both, that it's not just online or on land, mm-hmm. that there are ways to work in social media and work, with technology that can feel like they are on land. And quite honestly, I imagine there are ways to work with real people in person and have it feel like it's online because it's impersonal and it's not warm and it's not the way that we would really even want to present ourselves as leadership or even just as a congregant to our congregations and our communities. So, you spoke a little bit about Sleepy Hollow, and I imagine that that's really where the genesis of this idea of big small towns came from.
Yeah.
So speak a little bit about this idea that's in your book about big small towns and specifically within a congregational setting.
Yeah.
And I think that it doesn't matter whether or not we're talking about a congregation or a community that is 100 family units or 1,750 family units. I think, similarly, you can kind of have that same feeling in both of those settings. But so tell me a little bit about that.
So the idea of big small towns actually begins the chapter before in what I call the tyranny of the dichotomy, right? So this is the best part, Lior, about writing books. You get to come up with your own words and your own phrases, right? And so tyranny of dichotomy is trying to get us out of these extreme ways of thinking, right? That we are living either online or on land. And part of the problem of those ways of thinking is it becomes so easy for traditional leaders to dismiss social media, right? That it's not civil, so you can't be there.
It's light.
It's light. It's taking away from our in-person engagement. And we need to put that kind of thinking aside and say it's not one or the other. It's an and, as you mentioned. And this is where the idea of big small towns come from, right? We are always, as far as we know, into the future, are going to be living somewhere, right? We have a home somewhere. We have a school somewhere. We hopefully have a synagogue somewhere. We need that. We need to come together. We are, somebody was saying to me a couple of weeks ago, we're hopelessly communal people. That's who we are, right? At the same time, most of us also are living a certain percentage of our lives online,
right?
And doing both of those things can augment one another. It's not a substitute for one or the other. And what synagogues can do by combining the two is you get the reach online, you get the light touches of being inclusive, of connecting with somebody you may not have seen for a while, of staying in touch with former members, which is a lovely thing to do, and maybe even starting conversations online that you bring on land or vice versa as a way to continue conversations and continue to learn people's stories, which I think is really one of the most important things that we need to do that we don't do enough of. Everybody has a story. It's our obligation to learn those stories and to deepen the connection that we have with people. And it will happen online and on land.
So I'm going to keep asking some questions, but I'm also going to encourage all of you to please send in your questions as we go along, because through the magic of technology, we now have access to those questions, even as we are talking.
Tonight, this is our big
small
town.
Exactly. This is our big small town right here. We are in a big small town.
Right.
You know, and it's interesting, you spoke about the stories, and I found I worked in a congregational setting for a long time, for many, many years as a director of community engagement. And one of the things that we found in terms of our social media was that it was less effective and less powerful often to use social media, whether it was Facebook or our website, to just sort of send out, you know, yet another reminder about the conversation that we were going to have, even when it was a fascinating conversation, to send out a conversation that we were going to have, you know, about a book club or about an event that was happening at the synagogue. We found that that was far less effective of a use of our social media than literally when we just told stories. And that even if we had that sort of combined attention of, but this program really needs another push, and we know that if we put it on Facebook, or we know that if we put it on the website, it's going to get, you know, 600 eyes on it. It actually would get 1,200 eyes on it when we told that same message as a story. Oh, you know, Susie Goldberg is going to be at this place because of her connection to this story.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about why that works and how that works.
So what you're describing is the transition from broadcast to conversation. And in my experience...
See, I knew there was a...
there's a thing.
Now I'm going to go and tell this. And I'm like, see, I was explaining broadcast
to conversation.
Yeah.
This is... It's so funny. Of the things that we need institutions to get comfortable with, Leora, this one is maybe the hardest. Because everybody who grew up a little while ago, who is what I would call a grown-up, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, we were taught broadcast,
right?
We were taught to control the message in the messenger.
Right.
We were taught every chance you have, get that message out there. And now we have the most powerful tools for conversation in the history of mankind.
Right.
And the default setting of organizations is to keep using them as billboards.
Right.
What you were doing was you were making the transition to a different kind of conversation with people, which requires us to take the walls down, to let people in a little bit, to ask questions instead of just make statements, and to allow for storytelling to happen.
Yeah.
It takes practice. It is not an easy transition to make.
So I'm going to ask you a question about that. One of the hardest things about doing that was, you know, finding some people who were willing to tell their stories.
Right.
And who were willing to be in conversation with us.
Right.
And that was a tension that was also combined with, you know, sort of trying to figure out how do we really have the time, those of us who were working either lay leadership or synagogue professionals, how do we find the time to, you know, how do I find the time to spend 30 minutes on the phone with Susie Goldberg and hear about her story?
Right.
And, you know, what does that mean?
So here is one of the most exciting parts of life in a social media world.
Okay.
And that is that working with people instead of at them means that we can tap into the social networks that are out there, and we can get out of the mindset that we inside the walls are supposed to do everything alone.
Okay.
We have a network of really smart people of goodwill out there, and there are people who want to help. And in our congregations, in our networks, are people who are really good at tapping into those stories.
Okay.
That doesn't have to be a staff job.
Right.
So when we start to spread out the work, when we give little pieces of things that people are good at, that they're excited about, the work gets easier.
Right.
It means getting out of our committee mindsets. It means getting out of the idea that staff are supposed to have all the answers and do most of the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And it means tapping into all of this latent capital we have in our networks for ideas, for creativity, for social connections, and then finally for financial resources that are ready to be tapped. People, here, we need to start from the premise, Leora, that our people are good and kind and want to help us.
Right.
Right?
Right?
We know it. I say it to you. You say, of course, but we don't work that way.
Right.
And that's part of the values gap that we have.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because even as we were sort of thinking about this series and the challenges that we were going to have because it's a webinar and so we're already, you know, sort of, I think, to some extent hemmed in by the fact that you and I are talking, but we don't necessarily have 50 people sitting in the room. So I can't see all of you. I don't know whether or not you are scratching your head or shaking your head or, you know, grumbling and saying, I totally disagree. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about was how do we try and make even this experience a little bit more interactive? And the hope was people, we still hope that you're going to send in questions and some are starting to come in now. So that it can be a little bit more of an open conversation. And my question is, in a congregational setting, let's shift away a little bit from the social media piece of it.
Yeah.
In a congregational setting, there is also then, you know, something that you talk about in the book, you know, this idea of the unpredictable conversations that are going to come up, right? The unpredictable things that are going to happen in your congregations or in your communities, whether from the staff side or the congregant side. Where you feel like we've done so much work, we have really put so much time and effort into planning an initiative or a concept or a worship experience, and then for whatever reason, you know, again, poor Susie Goldberg, I'm just going to keep using her. She's not a real person. You know, but then Susie Goldberg, out of nowhere, comes up to the rabbi or comes up to the lay leader afterwards and says, you know, I understand that you thought that this was going to be great, but my experience of it was that it really wasn't.
Right.
You know, that this didn't make me feel more welcome. Or,
or
I walked in and nobody said hello to me, even though there were 15 greeters. And and why did that happen?
Right.
You know, so I want to ask about, you know, it was a really interesting piece of the book when you talked about the unpredictable conversations and that if we are a little bit more open to them happening, we will likely get to an even better place than
That's
if we just shut them down, go into the other room and say, oh, well, Susie Goldberg just complains about everything.
Right.
So
we all have Susie Goldberg.
Right.
I understand that.
I love Susie Goldberg.
Right. But so here's the piece that you're hitting on, which is the fear of losing control,
okay,
right? That is at the heart of a lot of the difficulty that synagogues are having in this moment of great transition.
Okay.
What happens if I can't control the conversation?
Right.
If we're criticized in public, which seems to be like
on
the
Facebook,
sky is
what if all
falling,
of a sudden somebody starts saying terrible things about
terrible
us?
Things. And to me, that is your
We should delete it, right?
I know.
No,
right? We should
I
shut
know.
The whole
I'm
thing
just
down.
Kidding.
That is the greatest opportunity you have because it's likely that Susie Goldberg isn't the only one who's disaffected or disappointed, and she's speaking for other people as well. If you're going to work with people, Leora, then you have to be open to what they actually think and not afraid of it.
Yeah.
And critics can be your very best friends because largely, unless they're really outliers, they're criticizing because they love you and they want you to do better.
Right.
They want you to do this thing better. You can only do it better if you're listening and in conversation with them.
So can you give an example?
I sure can. I'm going to give you a really big example that took actually a couple of years to unfold at my synagogue.
Okay.
We were hit. I became president right as the recession began.
Mm-hmm.
Not an easy time to do that. And we were hit very hard financially. We're a small-ish congregation, 400 families.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been around for 115 years, so we're doing something right. There was a lot of latent anger in the institution. We weren't doing a good job of listening to people. And I remember, and this was right when I was starting to think about matterness as well, I remember, you know, I got in there and I rolled my sleeves up, Lyra, because that's what you want to do as a leader. And people complained about the parking. They complained about the doors being locked. And I'm working hard every day to fix problems. And then I remember getting a call from an elderly congregant who was so upset. She had been sick in the hospital the week before and nobody called. And she ended it, there was actually an email, and she said, even though I didn't tell anybody. And it was one of those that just made you stop and go, what in the world is going on here? And it, the essence of that was not mattering, right? That she was feeling completely anonymous. She'd been a member here for 50 years, and we didn't care enough about her.
And I would even add, you know, in terms of that unpredictable conversation piece of it, you know, in defense of her, you didn't even notice that she wasn't there.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, we could stop it at, but she didn't even tell us.
Yeah.
Okay. In some perfect world, you would have been told that she was going to be in the hospital. However, for somebody who's been a regular at the synagogue, nobody noticed that she wasn't there.
The most hurt that I've heard of people at Synagogue Life always is about, I didn't go to Torah study, or I wasn't at services, and nobody cared, right? Like, I'm anonymous here. And it's hardest in synagogue life because there's no place where you want to matter more than in the synagogue that you've been a member for a long time. So we had a lot of latent anger from people. And we had a board that was very old school, very closed, very, very concerned about the finances. And even using phrases like, well, I even hate to say this, but I'll say it to you because we're friends. Freeloaders, to describe people who are asking for dues relief. Mm-hmm. That is like nails on a chalkboard to me. So we began a process in the boardroom of changing our language, right? We're not going to talk about our own people this way. We began to start to make people feel like they mattered by making high holiday calls, thanking them for being members. That was it.
Yeah.
Happy New Year. Thank you for being members. And people would wait.
Right.
They would wait for the ask.
You're going to, this must be a development call. No, it's not. Just Shana Tova.
Shana Tova. Yeah. And thank you so much for sticking with us. Yeah. We don't have everything down pat here. We're still trying to, you know, figure some things out, but thanks for sticking with us. It's really important. You're important to us.
Right.
Right. And we want to know how you are. And we began to change the conversation. Any opportunity I personally had to take a complaint and bring it on to our Facebook group, I would do. Somebody would complain that we sent out too much email.
Okay.
And I'd say, well, we're trying to tell you about things we think the congregation wants to know about. And I understand that you think you feel like you're getting too many. Help me figure this out. How do we figure it out? Which is how we began to segment some of our communication.
So instead of it becoming a conversation that was split between congregants and professional staff, where the congregant would bring something forward and then the professional staff would sit behind
a closed door.
In the best of intentions, but sit behind a closed door and work it out between yourselves.
Right.
It was instead an open conversation where it was, you've brought something forward, now let me respond and let's hear how you respond and let's see where we
can
come to.
And that's the only way we can become a we, right? How do we get out of the us and them? We got to take the wall down and start to problem solve together. Mm-hmm. Fast forward 3 years, and ultimately we ended up having a congregation-wide conversation online and on land in over 20 parlor meetings 2 years ago in living rooms and at a synagogue about the dues model, about how that felt so off-putting to people, how it judged people. We were defining what families were. Who's a family? Who's a single?
Right.
How often do you come?
Right.
We were losing post-B'nai Mitzvah families.
Right.
That didn't suit them. It wasn't flexible enough.
Right.
Last January, we voted overwhelmingly. I think it was like 83-3 to move from dues to donations, the first synagogue in Westchester to do that.
Wow.
And it's going extremely well.
So some of this, I think, is about the way that we connect the values that we espouse, because I think, you know, all of us who are working in the Jewish community, we're hoping toward going toward the best thing.
That's right.
I mean, we're hoping toward going toward sacred conversation and holiness and openness. But I think that there is sometimes a disconnect between the values that we espouse and the way that we sometimes end up behaving.
That's
which,
right.
You know, I think that some of what the purpose of the conversation is really is for us to not pull punches tonight. You know, I don't need to just sit here tonight and say, oh, we're all doing the best that we can and it's all so lovely and wonderful. The fact of the matter is that we are all trying to do the best that we can. However, I think that there are times when we're not able to make that connect between the values that we truly believe in our hearts and how sometimes those values are played out.
Right.
And quite honestly, I think we all can be a little bit, we can be a little bit nicer to ourselves. Sometimes that's just being a human.
Right.
And it's okay that we are human. However, I think that then there does need to be that next step of, okay, so then now that we've recognized that we're humans, how do we align that a little bit better?
Right. So, the area I think for synagogues to think about most is the most common phrase that we have almost in synagogue life, where you go down to any website, yeah, and that is, we are warm
and welcoming, right? Because
right?
Really, what synagogue is going to put up right? on their website? We are cold and uninviting.
We're cold
please
and cookish.
Right, please don't come in. Right. We don't actually want you.
We don't
right.
want you.
Yes.
Right. So we're warm and welcome.
Yes.
The experience of
right.
congregants is often that it's hard to get in.
Yeah.
It's hard to know anybody. Yeah. I wasn't greeted. And it feels cliquish
mm-hmm.
here.
Right.
So we have this very large gap between the very genuine interests of the institution and the experience of a lot of people there.
Right.
And what happens in that mix, Leora, is what I call the churn takes
the
over,
churn,
right? So the
yeah.
churn is the super duper busyness of people on the inside of any institution. But, you know, in this instance, synagogue life, right? When you look at, and, you know, we're overly concerned with process. We're overly concerned with trying to control everything. We're overly concerned with anything ever possibly going wrong,
right?
As opposed to thinking about being iterative and experimenting. And how much time it takes to deal with those issues, right? So an experiment, here's an experiment for folks.
Yeah.
Look at your agendas for your staff meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Are those agendas filled with the, here's our process and we're going to check it and recheck it and triple check it.
Okay.
Let's spend 40 minutes next Monday talking about what could go wrong with our new
right.
program.
Right. How could this go sideways?
How could this right. go sideways? Who's going to get in trouble
right.
when that happens?
Right.
And how to deal with cranky congregants, right? When if you put those three things together, you
right.
have the majority of most agendas.
Yeah.
What's not on the agendas in those cases, Leora, are we reaching out to people we haven't seen in a while?
Yeah.
How do we know that our congregants feel like we know who they are and we care about them?
Yeah.
What data, what indicators do we have? But that's actually true, not just in our mind, right?
Right.
And what are we going to do this year to actually be warm and welcoming? What's going to be different?
So we actually, I thank you, those of you that are writing in questions, we are getting some questions, so I thank you because that's going to help us change the modality a little bit. So the first question that we have is, do you find that congregants would prefer to hear from board members, from other congregants, from the staff at the synagogue?
Mm.
What is kind of the best mix of that to
mm-hmm.
make people really feel like this isn't just a top-down organization or this isn't, similarly, this isn't just a bottom-up organization?
Well, I think it has to be a mix.
Okay.
I don't think there's any one right person to
mm-hmm.
be doing this. And I hope that there is a mix both of lay leaders and staff and clergy.
Mm-hmm.
For us, having clergy online in the Facebook group is fantastic,
yeah.
right? You want to know where the rabbi has been, who he's meeting with, what he's
right.
thinking about. It's terrific.
Right.
Having staff accessible is fantastic.
Right.
But most of all, having not just lay leaders, but lay people engaged in conversation about synagogue life and just about community life and where people are
okay.
Is fantastic. One of the best weeks we've ever had in our synagogue life was Hurricane Sandy. and how we used our Facebook group, and the building happened to have electricity as a place to convene, and a way to convene. Yeah.
So somebody's asking specifically how you train people to do this in the best way, and asking actually even more specifically in small congregations, you know, in a place that has, you know, 80 family units. And, you know, so I think that the assumption is we all really do know each other.
Right.
But how do we really make this work best? And I would say I think that this is probably both an online and an on land question. Yeah.
So the first issue is to find somebody who has an interest in being a conversational leader, right? Mm-hmm. That it's not, we lead Leora by what we do, not where we sit.
Okay.
Right? Keep that in mind. So anybody, anywhere in your ecosystem can become a conversational leader, right? Somebody who's good at facilitation. Maybe you have somebody in your congregation like we do who does focus groups for a living. It's fantastic,
right?
Maybe you have somebody who just loves Facebook.
Right?
Take advantage of that. Right. In addition, there are resources. There are resources through the URJ. There are resources at C3, which is a fantastic group.
It's
Dream Online. They're a communications group doing online work. Lots of resources that you can find to help learn how to facilitate these conversations online, on land, better. But I wouldn't worry about, is this in somebody's job description? It's more important that the person is enjoying being a conversation leader. That's something that they're good at.
Okay, but so now I'm going to push a little on that.
Go ahead.
So, you know, now I've got various different people who have come forward and said, I want to help, I want to do, I'm ready to do this.
Yeah.
And that there's sometimes a little bit of a disconnect between somebody who says that they are great at it and the way that that then actually plays out.
Right.
That maybe they are great at it, sometimes they are less great at it.
Right.
You know, and how do you then, or how do we really find the capital? You know, and you talk about this a little bit in the book, but how do I then find the capital that that person has? You know, my role when I was working in the synagogue really was to always find a way to say yes. You know, now I might not be saying yes necessarily to what you think you are asking, but there always has to be a way for me to be able to say yes to the people that are stepping forward and wanting to do things. But so is there training that happens? You know, do we bring everybody together who's interested on one evening, on four evenings, and, you know, go through some very real, you know, technical pieces about what this looks like. How does it happen?
Great.
Good.
So it's yes and, right? You're going to find that there are some people who are just going to jump online wherever you are. If it's Twitter, if it's Facebook, if it's your blog, and just do.
Right.
Hoorah. They should be encouraged to do that.
Yeah.
If you want to get more intentional, if the synagogue wants to create a content calendar, say for the year, right, which is getting very intentional, which says we're going to have conversation throughout the year, but we're also, we want to do something fun around Hanukkah. We want to do something fun around Purim, right?
Okay.
We want to have a conversation about costumes and what they mean in your life and what, you know, what dress means in your life. That needs to be planned. And then it's also an opportunity to train staff and lay people on how to engage conversationally, how to ask questions instead of broadcast, how to tag people, how to post pictures, a whole bunch of things that can be done.
And I want to shift a little bit away from online and onto on land.
Yeah.
You know, so what are two or three things that, and this is a question that has come up from
our people.
From the people with whom we are in conversation.
Our big small town.
Exactly. So what are two or three things that congregational leaders should start to do to make a habit to sort of help bringing matterness to life in the congregation?
Yes. Here's what we need to do, Leora. Okay. We need to stop thinking about programs and start thinking about people.
Yes. Thank you, Jonah Pesner.
I adore Jonah. Hurrah. Yes. Think about every opportunity you have for people to learn something about one another.
Right.
Right. This is part of the churn. The churn is when programs take over.
Right.
Right. That we need to teach people something, that they need to be invited to the temple to learn something, to do something.
Right.
People just need to be. Right. Anytime that we can organize Shabbat dinners, that we can have a bagel on a Sunday morning together, we don't need to be programmed to do that. What we can do is we can try to get unusual suspects there,
okay,
so that they can connect with people. I've always found that for us, our progressive dinners, where mm-hmm. people are hosting dinners in their homes, and you meet people you wouldn't ordinarily, is the most powerful thing that we do during the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's how people make new friendships,
right,
which is fantastic.
Right.
Or a chavara program of smaller groups of people being social, you know,
right,
together.
Right.
I think it's really important. Remember, we were talking about agendas.
Yeah.
Really important that staff agenda and the board agenda carves out time to talk about when can we be people together,
okay,
where and how are we going to learn each other's stories,
yep,
and are we taking care of one another? And that has to get on the agenda, because if it's not on the agenda, it's not going to happen.
Okay. So we are right now in the midst of Sukkot.
Yes.
Right? We're right in the middle,
yes,
of it.
Being rained on here,
exactly,
on the East Coast.
Exactly. Although the Talmud teaches that as long as it doesn't ruin your soup, you,
yes,
are still supposed to eat in your Sukkah. So, you know, the beauty of a Sukkah is that there are sort of two messages that we can get from it. One is this idea that when we look up from our Sukkah there, you know, that the Sukkah really is in place so that it's foundational, but out of place enough so that it lets in the light and it lets in, you know, sort of what is above us. And I'm curious, let's start there. I'm curious, you know, sort of, how do we use that analogy to really think about what our congregations can be?
I think that's a beautiful analogy, Leora. Thank you for bringing,
sure,
it up and framing it that way. I think that we need to think of our institutions as open, as easy to get in and easy to get out.
Right.
And that the purpose of institutions, and I've wrestled with this question for the last 10 years, you know, what do we need institutions to do?
Right.
And they keep us coming together.
Yeah.
They are our institutional memory. They are our glue in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But they're only going to be able to be sustainable if they're more porous.
Okay.
If they're allowing people,
yeah,
to come and allowing them to go.
Right.
Allowing them, not judging, which is a huge issue, you know, in synagogue life. If you're,
yeah,
if you're new to the community or you're more lightly touched, anything,
right,
we can do to accept people where they are and what they want out of this experience, we have to do. And we can only do that if we're letting the air and the sun,
right,
and the stars,
right,
come through.
Space.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. And so the second piece of this Sukkot metaphor for me is really about this idea of ushpizin, of welcoming in guests.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, oftentimes when people talk about this idea that you're supposed to welcome in guests, and traditionally you're supposed to welcome in the historical biblical guests, but a lot of times there are ways that people talk about it in saying, so, you know, if there was anybody that you could welcome into your sukkah right now, who would it be? So first, I am actually going to change the modality a little bit. I'm going to give us all a minute. Without any talking, to just, I want everyone who's with us right now to think about if you could welcome anybody into your synagogue, into your community, into your congregation right now, who would that person be? So let's think about that for a minute. Okay, who are you inviting in?
I want to invite anybody in our community who is searching right now.
All right. Okay. And I'm glad to know this, that people are writing in. Please do write in more. So some of the people that people have decided to invite into our Sukkot this year are Moses and Rabbi Rick Jacobs. So I will be sure to tell both of them tomorrow that they are invited into various Sukkot this year.
Will Rick Jacobs bring the Pope with him?
Maybe.
Right?
You never know.
Now that he and the Pope are close.
And you know, the other day I was in a conversation with a group of people, and one person said that the person that she would invite in is actually her older self. because she's hoping in meeting her older self to see where she grows.
Yeah.
You know, she said she's at a place right now that's very transitional in life,
yeah.
and she was feeling, I think, a little bit unstable and is hopeful that by meeting her 65-year-old self,
yeah.
She will see that it's okay, that it's going to be okay. Right,
yeah.
which I also felt was really lovely. So, you know, one of the questions that somebody has written in is, you know, in this inviting,
yes,
right, and in this idea of Ushpizin and inviting people in, the question is, how do you get people to show up without an agenda?
Yeah.
You know, if I don't have my objective and my agenda and I want my millennials or I want my baby
yeah.
boomers, you know, so how do I make sure, what do I do to make sure that they do show up?
So we're back actually to the tyranny of the dichotomy,
yeah.
right? That oftentimes when I'm speaking to people, they are hearing that everything happens online, or
mm-hmm.
they're hearing I'm saying throw process out the window, or
right.
there are no rules here. And I want to reassure people
right.
That process is necessary, and we
right.
do need rules, and we do need some programs.
Yeah.
We do need reasons for people to come together.
Yeah.
Here's what I'd love to see, though. My ideal, Leora, would be for every congregation to have a meeting, say July, right? A congregational-wide meeting. And we make a big open space together. And we talk about what are the things that we want to learn together next year.
This coming year. Yeah.
And how do we want to go about doing that? And, of course, we need ritual, and we're going to need fundraising, we need building. Let's say we're going to do those three things.
Right.
Then we've got big pieces of paper up around the room. Now, what else do we want to do?
Right. We.
And we.
All of
and
us.
I want the congregation
right.
to own
right.
the programming for the next year.
Right.
And I want to stop doing programs at people either because we've always done them.
Right.
That's the churn.
Right.
right? We just keep doing that same, you know, program every year. Or because we just assume that people will like these things.
Yeah.
The more that we are inclusive in our planning for the year, the more that people will participate in developing them, in manning them,
right.
and in coming to them. And that's how we're going to change the us and them to the we.
Right. right. So this is a technical question that's come up, that someone was wondering if there really is a good database that can sort of help track the connections between and among members and lay leaders and staff. And,
yeah.
You know, I think certainly in large congregations, but also in small congregations,
yeah.
It's not a bad thing to say there are some technical things that are going to help us do this. So do you
Absolutely.
Have suggestions of
no,
programs?
I don't. No, we started to look at Salesforce. I believe
right,
they have
right,
a template
yeah.
for
right,
synagogues.
Right.
I know Ideal
right.
Wear did a survey of
okay.
Databases for synagogues
mm-hmm.
a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But I don't have the answer on that.
Right.
But the question is just the right question.
Right. right. And I know that there's a lot of conversation lately about data. And I know that, you know, at some synagogues, certainly at the synagogue where I was working, we had a program that was put into place that was not that hard to put into place, where we really just started doing a better job of taking down RSVPs
right.
and putting them into categories of things that people came to. Oh, you came to something
right.
and it was split into three different topics. This one was Israel and music and history. And there were all different kinds of topics that we could sort of categorize it under. And then it turned out that if I did something later in the year, if I wanted to have a conversation with people who were interested in the Israel conversation,
right.
I knew who it was that had already been involved
exactly.
in that conversation. So instead of sending out an email literally to 1,750 families saying everybody might be interested in this, I was able to send out an email to only, you know, 200 families and
right.
say, this is something that I know that you're interested in.
Right.
So here's an interesting question that has come up, is that somebody is asking, so I want to create a community where my 20-something, I think it says introvert skeptic brother, wants to come and learn and celebrate. I'm going to add something to that question, right? So so now I have a 20-something introvert skeptic brother. I also, in real life, am married to an extrovert atheist husband.
Mm.
Grew up Jewish, not embarrassed of being Jewish. That's
mm-hmm.
he's happy to be there.
Mm-hmm.
He just isn't interested in the God conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so along the way, a lot of our conversations that I think also are part of my 20-year-old skeptic brother are Yes, a lot of congregational life and synagogue life is and should be about worship and about my relationship with God and about prayer. But what are some of the other ways in,
right,
for people so that they can feel like they matter? So that
right.
my husband doesn't feel like everyone who walks up to him says, you know, oh, don't worry, someday when something bad happens, you'll
right.
start believing.
Right.
To which his response is usually secretly to me later, oh, don't worry, someday when something bad happens, you will stop believing. but, you know, what do we, how do we make sure that the people like my 20-year-old skeptic brother feel like there is an inquisitiveness
yes.
that is happening in synagogue,
right?
That it's not just the closed answer,
right.
but that it's that open answer of the sukkah. So how do we do that?
I think that there are two areas in particular that are of great interest to both the skeptic
yes.
and the atheist.
Okay.
And that's social justice and political justice.
Right.
And
yeah,
those happen to be two areas where the reform movement is
yeah.
fantastic. And I think any congregation that wants to strengthen,
yeah.
Broaden the number of people that they are reaching and connecting with people who are frankly not moved by worship and ritual, which is not for everybody.
Right.
It is going to be through social justice and through political engagement.
Right. right.
And I would strengthen those areas.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And somebody also pointed out that we also have to make a real concerted effort to invite the people in who haven't felt like they've mattered in the
yes.
last 5 years. And
yes.
to make sure that we're reaching out to them again, you know, not, oh, I'm going to be, this is part of the, we're working out how to do a webinar. Lisa is pointing at something, but I don't know what she's pointing at. The second one? Okay, great. All right. You know, and A, how do I invite in the people that have not felt like they've mattered?
Yes.
You know, sort of how do I go back and say, okay, I think that I haven't made you feel the way that I should. And
right.
how do I do that in a genuine way?
Right.
And similarly, you know, so I think then the second part of that question, which is another question, is, you know, the congregational meetings that many of us have, the people that show up are the regulars.
Yep.
What do we do at those meetings so that we can say, nope, this isn't just going to be the same old,
yep.
where we, you know, go through some bylaws and,
right.
you know, the rabbi or cantor does some sort of benediction.
Right.
You know, so on the one hand, how do we invite people in general who
yeah.
have felt like they haven't really mattered?
Right.
And then secondly, in a more specific way, if we were to do a congregational meeting,
right.
what could we do at that meeting that would change it a little, make it feel different?
So let's take the first one. And what happens in institutional life is we get stuck with what I call conversation stoppers.
Okay.
And the conversation stoppers in the instance you bring up of how do we engage, you know, more people, particularly more lightly touched people in terms of matterness. The issue is that it feels overwhelming, that the numbers are too big.
Right.
And our charge, if we really want to make people known, acknowledged, and empowered,
right.
our charge is to actually treat them like real
like
people.
People. Right. Yes.
Which actually means sending an individual email or making a phone call.
Right.
10 people you haven't seen in a while.
Yeah.
10 people, you know, who may have been involved before have lessened their involvement. Or 10 people you think could be, you know, interested in doing something and invite them. As individuals.
But Allison, I'm tired. I'm working
yeah.
really hard
yeah.
and I am either running the book club next week or I am working on my sermon
yeah.
for, you know, tomorrow night.
Right.
So where am I supposed to find the time to make 10 phone calls?
Yes. So you have an entire boardroom filled with people,
right?
And there's a chunk of those people who don't know why they're on this board. And it's likely some of them are feeling like they're edging towards outsiderness as
right.
well. This is what we did in our dues to donations conversations and having our parlor
yep.
meetings. We took special care to make sure that we were getting outside of the usual suspects.
Right.
We needed to hear from people who were disaffected or had never been, you know, terribly involved. Had to be personal, had to be phone call, email, and it made a huge difference. When
right.
you use somebody's name
yeah. Yeah.
to say, I would love to see you.
Yeah.
I think this might interest you, this
yeah.
meeting, this topic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And then you take that same concept and you extend it to the congregational meeting, right? Maybe it's a conversation when you tag people or you have individual conversations of what could we discuss at the congregational meeting that you think would be of interest to you, right? Is there a political discussion we could have? Is there a discussion on social justice we could have before or after the meeting? That would make this more than just business as usual for you. We could have a speaker in. We could do a whole bunch of things.
Right. So somebody wrote in that they had interviewed people about their stories for their parent community, and then they published them.
Yes.
What do you think about doing this by video? What do you think about doing this by video?
Huh. So the people who are being cared for are telling their own stories?
Yeah. Like, well, a story core, probably.
Yeah. I hope so. I love any opportunity somebody has to tell their own story.
Yeah.
We don't need to tell people stories for them. That's why social media are so powerful.
Right.
People can tell their own stories.
Right.
Putting a face to it, making it live, putting it on video.
Yeah.
Hoorah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I would do it from both ends. I would do it from the person who cared for them as well as the person who got the care.
Yeah.
Because both sides are very powerful.
Yeah. So we are going to need to wrap up a little. I'm gonna end with a little story and then one last question, and then we're going to have you tell us the names of the titles of your books again. So so the story is that there's a story about a congregation, and the rabbi noticed that there was a woman who had not been coming as often as she generally did. Started asking around, did something happen? Is there something I should know about? And her friend said, no, she's not as connected right now as she used to be. So this was in the Midwest. It was in the middle of a bit of a snowstorm. The rabbi actually drove out to her house and rang the doorbell. She opened the door. He didn't say anything, walked into her house. There was a fire in the fireplace. He walked over to the fireplace and he took a poker and he moved one coal off to the side, and then went and sat down on her couch and still said nothing.
Mm-hmm.
She sat on the other couch. They both looked at the fire for a while, 10, 15 minutes. And as they sat there, the one coal that he had moved off to the side on its own died off,
mm-hmm.
while the rest of the fire continued to burn. And they stood up. He walked over to the door. They've still said nothing to each other. Just as he was leaving, he looked at her and he said, "Will I see you next week?" And she said, "I'll be there."
Mm-hmm.
You know, with that story in mind, with this idea of matterness, with people feeling like, yep, when we are all together, that's when we burn brighter. That is when this works better. That is when we learn more as a community, as a Jewish community. That is when we do more social justice. That is when we pray deeper together. What does this look like when it's successful?
Oh, what a great question, Leora. I don't think it's what it looks like as much as what does this feel like when it's successful. And what it feels like is love.
Okay.
And it feels like humanity at its very best. Because when people matter to one another, then we go beyond the easy outs with people. Somebody's difficult or somebody has problems.
Okay.
And we get to that deeper level of there's a great goodness in everybody who's here. And the role of the synagogue is to create opportunities for that goodness to come out and be shared.
Right.
And that's what it feels like.
Right. Good. Okay. So remind us of the titles of your book.
Oh, sure. So Momentum was the first one 10 years ago. And then there's the Network Nonprofit 5 years ago. And then the latest is called Matterness, Fearless Leadership for a Social World.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My
thank
pleasure.
You all for being here. And you can continue to write questions and be in touch with Lisa and Deborah and with each other. And we'll continue having these conversations throughout the year.
Thank you.